It's Tuesday, March 26, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Today, the stage is set in Washington, D.C. for one of the most momentous weeks in our constitutional history. Today, oral arguments in two cases related to same-sex marriage will be heard before the nation's highest court. And there in the august and impressive formal courtroom of the U.S. Supreme Court, the justices will hear the case made both pro and con in terms of the legalization of same-sex marriage, but not in an abstract sense. The justices, as is always the case for an appellate court and the final court of appeals in this country, will be hearing cases that have already been heard by lower courts. These cases are being heard on appeal. And the final court of appeal, the United States Supreme Court, is now going to consider whether lower courts ruled rightly on the issue of same-sex marriage in relation to two specific cases. The first relates to DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, passed overwhelmingly by Congress and signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1996, and Proposition 8, the measure that was adopted by the voters of California in 2008. This stipulates in the Constitution of that state that marriage is the union of a man and a woman and is exclusively so. The big question, of course, as many legal analysts are now set for the hearings today and tomorrow, is whether we will receive a signal from the justices as to the direction they are likely to go in terms of an eventual decision or set of decisions in these two cases. But observers of the court over a long period of time know that listening to the justices and watching carefully their discussion and their probing questions, this does not necessarily point to any understanding of eventually where the court will come. Nevertheless, it does tend to indicate where the justices, who may be sitting in very different positions on these questions, consider weak arguments in the particular cases being argued before them. As has already been discussed and will be continuing a point of concern, one of the biggest questions is whether or not the justices will decide to rule, as is often described, narrowly or broadly on the question of same-sex marriage. Will they rule, for instance, in Proposition 8 in a way that will be limited to the state of California, or will they find a way to rule in a way that will affect all 50 states? This is where recent observers of the court and those who have gone through the legal briefs, and I've done much of that myself, have detected a change in the argument, and that is, there is now the assessment that unless on Proposition 8 the court rules on the very narrow question of standing, that is, the court deciding that no one actually has a right to bring the case before the court, therefore allowing the lower court decisions to stand, there will have to be some kind of broad decision handed down because of the nature of the question the court will have to consider. In Proposition 8, the court will have to consider the question as to whether or not gays and lesbians, those seeking legalized same-sex unions, are a class, a protected class, for which there would be the very careful scrutiny, close scrutiny as it's called, of rules and laws and statutes on the basis of their constitutionality. In other words, the United States Supreme Court is going to have to rule, if indeed it does rule on anything broader than the question of standing, as to whether or not gays and lesbians have a fundamental right to same-sex marriage. Now, if they rule that there is no such fundamental right, that will be a very broad decision. It'll be a broad decision in that it would allow to stand, at least on that basis, the 40-plus states that have adopted constitutional amendments and similar measures outlawing same-sex marriage. They could rule that in California it's unconstitutional without making any assessment or judgment about the similar pieces of constitutional law elsewhere. But when it comes to a ruling in the other direction, if indeed the justices or a majority of the justices find that there is a fundamental right for same-sex couples to marry, then that would have to be applied to all 50 states in the broadest application of their decision possible. So there is a lot at stake here. And the nation's opinion meisters know that. For instance, the editorial board of the New York Times on March the 23rd, published an editorial entitled Heightened Scrutiny. They say this: one of the central questions in the two gay marriage cases to be argued before the Supreme Court is whether gays and lesbians are a protected class under the Constitution. Under longstanding principles, government actions that fall heavily on discrete and insular minorities historically subject to prejudice and stigma are to be given particular scrutiny. Then they continue by saying this: the 3.4% of Americans who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender clearly qualify as this kind of minority. Laws classifying individuals based on sexual orientation, the Anti-Gay Marriage Initiative in California called Proposition 8, and the Federal Defense of Marriage Act must be given heightened scrutiny, end quote. It's a very interesting and boldly assertive case, and it's exactly what you would expect from the editorial board of the New York Times. But you'll notice they simply say that they clearly qualify, that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered persons clearly qualify as this kind of minority. You need to note that if they are identified as this kind of minority, on the question of marriage, the issue will never be limited to the question of marriage. And that's where the editorial board of the New York Times knows exactly what it's doing. They write, gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender people share a common immutable characteristic because their sexual orientation is fundamental to who they are, and they have indisputably been discriminated against. Now, that's an interesting statement. In other words, they are clearly, boldly, without any qualification whatsoever, arguing that gays, lesbians, bisexual, and transgender people share a common immutable characteristic. In other words, they are arguing that sexual identity is absolutely immutable. It is thus unchangeable. It is thus to be recognized, according to the editorial board of the New York Times, on the same basis as, for instance, race. They then go on to say this, finally, gay and lesbians as a minority group cannot protect themselves from discrimination in a political process governed by the majority. If they had power, write the editors, Proposition 8 and the Defense of Marriage Act would never have been passed, nor would the laws currently on the books in 39 states that specifically restrict marriage to opposite-sex couples, end quote. This shows a basic disregard for the principles of democracy. It is true, of course, that the courts do exist, at least partly, for the cause of protecting minorities against the wrong use of majority power. But eventually, the courts themselves are at least sustained by the fact that a majority supports them. That's what it means when we talk about a country and a government that is by the people, of the people, and for the people. Eventually, the majority will have to at least support the court, if not the court's decision. But this is where the argument made by the editors of the New York Times begins to lose traction and lose it fast. They write, gays and lesbians, as a minority group, cannot protect themselves from discrimination in a political process governed by the majority. They identify gays and lesbians as approximately 3.4% of the population. But keep in mind that in November of last year, voters in Maine and in Maryland and in Washington State, by majorities, voted to legalize same-sex marriage. In other words, the editors can't have it both ways. They can't celebrate democratic victories for same-sex marriage and then say, on the other hand, that they can't happen. They're looking here at the fact that they simply do not like the democratic results in the states that have outlawed same-sex marriage. On the other side of the ideological divide comes the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal, and by no surprise, in an editorial published in yesterday's edition of that paper entitled Marriage and the Supreme Court, the Wall Street Journal warns the court that it must not overreach. They write, quote, over time, through popular consent, the law comes to reflect an evolving social consensus. On gay marriage, state by state, election by election, voters are extending to gay and lesbian couples the same rights and responsibilities that pertain to a union between a man and a woman. These choices are the pith of self-government, even if fair-minded voters in other states preserve their traditional meaning. The editors then go on to write, if the Supreme Court now reads a right to gay marriage into the Constitution and imposes that definition on all states, it won't settle the debates Americans are conducting. It will inflame them and ensure they never end. Prematurely aborting the give and take on contentious moral and social issues the Constitution is designed to encourage. Five justices or fewer, if they split into pluralities, could further jeopardize the body politic and make compromise more difficult. End quote. That is a profoundly accurate statement that is a minimal assessment of what the Supreme Court now risks doing if indeed it decides to rule in a sweeping way in terms of the court's majority, finding a constitutional right to marriage for same-sex couples. There is so much to look at on the question of same-sex marriage, especially this week. We're often asked why these issues are so much in debate. It is because we're talking, after all, about the central institution of human society. Both sides in this argument know exactly what is at stake. And if you're looking at the media this week, you can expect an absolute avalanche of articles and news coverage on this question. And it will not end with this week, because the court will rule eventually, likely handing down its decision in June, and that will set the stage, whatever the court decides, for a social revolution we can see coming into shape as we look to the future. Meanwhile, writing at The Atlantic, Matthew Cooper writes, is legalized gay marriage inevitable? Don't be so sure. It is clear that the advocates of same-sex marriage believe they have the wind at their back, even as these oral arguments are now to come before the nation's highest court. But Cooper warns that there have been other movements that appeared to be unstoppable that were indeed stopped, and he points back to the 1970s and the demise of the Equal Rights Amendment. He writes, still it's instructive to go back to the 1970s and recall what happened. The Equal Rights Amendment, first proposed by suffragist Alice Paul, was introduced in Congress in 1923 by, among others, Susan B. Anthony's nephew. Its words were simple: equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex, end quote. Recall that that was 1923. It remained bottled up, but at times was uncorked. President Eisenhower, for instance, called for its passage in 1958. Later, Eleanor Roosevelt opposed it and then favored it. So did the League of Women Voters. By the 70s, it had huge support. It passed the House in October of 1971. It passed the Senate in the following year. That's 1972. Presidents don't get to vote on constitutional amendments, but they do get to speak to them. Richard Nixon endorsed it. President Ford endorsed it. Mrs. Gerald Ford, that is Betty Ford, endorsed it, but it died. And it died because an insufficient number of state legislatures approved the constitutional amendment. It did appear at one point to be absolutely inevitable, but it wasn't. Will that be the case with gay marriage? Time will tell. The situation is now different, precisely because we're not talking about a constitutional amendment that must be ratified by a sufficient number of states. We're talking about a case that is currently, as of today and tomorrow, pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. By the way, if you're looking at the issue of same-sex marriage, it's hard to get over what's happening in the corporate world. That was made clear in a now rather infamous exchange between Howard Schultz, the outspoken CEO of Starbucks, and a stockholder at its recent shareholder meeting. During the company's annual meeting, as Christine Kwan of Time Magazine reports, there was a confrontation at the shareholder meeting between stockholder Tom Stromhar and Howard Schultz, the CEO. At that meeting, Stromhar suggested that it was Starbucks as a company's aggressive support of same-sex marriage that was costing it business in the most recent quarter. Howard Schultz spoke up in a very vehement way. He said, quote, "If you feel respectfully you can get a higher return than the 38% you got last year, it's a free country. You can sell your shares of Starbucks and buy shares in another company. Thank you very much," end quote. According to Time Magazine, he received applause from the audience. But Howard Schultz is evidently concerned that it would look like the company is aggressively for same-sex marriage because they want to get to the bottom line. They want a financial return. He said this, quote, "The lens in which we're making that decision is through the lens of our people. We employ over 200,000 people in this company, and we want to embrace diversity," end quote. That's the kind of corporate speak, the use of the word diversity there, that is very imprecise for a very important reason. It covers his argument here, but clearly, Starbucks discriminates all the time. They say here they want to embrace diversity, but I guarantee you they don't want all kinds of diversity. They want only politically correct kinds of diversity. Like many of you, we'll be watching the oral arguments very carefully today before the nation's highest court. Of course, I say watching when actually what we will be doing is listening, because the audio is to be posted in a timely fashion by the court in terms of its oral arguments. We can only wish we were able to see visually what will take place on today and tomorrow, these two historic days before the nation's highest court. There is no question that we have been experiencing a moral revolution over the course of the last several decades, and pornography has been at the forefront of that revolution. An obituary that appeared in many of the nation's leading newspapers over the weekend points to just how our culture has changed on that question. For instance, Michelle L. Price, writing an obituary for the Associated Press, talks about Harry Reams, who was the male star of the 1972 cultural phenomenon. I'm not going to mention the name of the movie, but let's just say it was the most famous or infamous pornographic movie of the 1970s. It was the one that broke the dam, so to speak, in terms of letting the entire flood of pornography come into this country. And, of course, it was a movie that made both him and his fellow actors famous or infamous because of its cultural popularity. It was, as the Associated Press says, a cultural phenomenon. But the reason it deserves our worldview attention today is not just because it was the leading edge of this plague of pornography, but because the definitions that were changed back in 1972 and in the court cases that followed made very clear just how pornography was a new part of America's cultural furnishing. For instance, as the Associated Press reports, when this movie was released in 1972, quote, "it dropped any pretense that it had educational value," end quote. That's the key line. In other words, pornography was marginalized in American culture, and legally it had to prove that it had some educational value. Now, much of that was a charade. It was a very interesting and thin defense of pornographic materials. But then, at least back then, the law did require at least some argument that the material had socially redeeming educational value. But as of 1976 and the release of this now infamous film, it no longer made any pretense of educational value. Of course, pornography never is about education. It is about the intentional effort to feed sexual desire in an improper way that is the very biblical definition of porneia, of pornography. And sometimes you find this kind of worldview point made in an unexpected place, such as an obituary for an aging porn actor who died, by the way, broken by the industry. As one friend said, quote, I met him long after he left the adult film industry. The adult film industry basically destroyed him. He would never talk about the salacious stuff. We always talked about how he was a survivor, end quote. But he survives no more. Finally, it becomes more and more clear just how secularized much of the world is becoming, and the leading edge of this has always been Northern and Western Europe. Now, Raf Kassert reporting for the Associated Press takes us to the town of Borgloon in Belgium, where a church has won a major architectural award. The church doesn't have a name, and it really doesn't need one because no one's ever going to meet in it. According to Kassert, quote, the church is made of rusty steel beams separated by gaps, and its austere beauty won it an international prize. It is described as representing eerie desolation. It is a see-through art installation, and it is a symbol of the secularized state of post-Christian Europe. In other words, this is a church that isn't about worship. It's a church that is basically about rafters with empty spaces, indicating the eclipse of Christianity on a continent that had once been the very heart of Christendom. It is a symbol of a doctrinally evacuated Christianity and of a continent now largely evacuated of the Christian faith altogether. It is a very interesting symbol, and of course, it's even more interesting that it won an architectural award. An architectural award in Europe, in Borgloon, Belgium, for a church that will never house worship and was never intended to. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.